Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here this evening. Tonight, we are going to be talking about several great novels written by Jack Woodville London. They are Children of a Good War, French Letters, French Letters, Virginia's War, Tierra, Texas, 1944, French Letters, Engaged in War. What's really great about these books is it really takes you on an adventure to be able to almost feel like you are on this parallel lifetime. You were just like so engaged in the story that you almost kind of have to shake your head and stop and say, where am I right now? It's almost in 2019, we're saying, how can we go back to stories of our life, of those around us, and really seeing what they're feeling, sensing, where they've come from? Isn't it many times people say, I have these elders and they want to tell their stories, and we only want to hear the story of drama or trauma or the hardships. And really we don't ask them about their heart and their soul and their loves along the way. What Jack has really done has woven all of these concepts of all of our emotions, all of our times of our heart, our soul, and even just every day-to-day life throughout all of these years. He puts it down on the page and it really draws you in. I found myself had to shake my head and say, okay, I got to stop for a minute. You know, I was really engaged in the story and I really almost felt as if one with it. And isn't that the great time when we say this author's really got it? They really are drawing us in, and we're not going to give the stories away today, but we will speak to Jack. And Jack, you can share with us about all of these adventures through your work, and it's such a pleasure to have you today.
Well, it's very kind of you to invite me to be on the show.
Oh, so welcome. Jack, don't you think that sometimes in your stories you just feel like you almost want to look down and say, where am I in the moment? Yes?
One of the greatest compliments I was ever given in one nanosecond of setting this up, the series title is called French Letters because it's built upon a series of letters written from a woman in France to her boyfriend, a woman in America to her boyfriend in France during World War II, and his replies from France during the war to her.
Right.
And I was visiting with someone from France some years ago about the French book.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, how long did you live in St. Lo? And I said, I've never lived in St. Lo.
Ah.
And he said, well, I was in St. Lo 2 months ago, and I went to the clerk's office. And I said, why? And he said, I wanted to know where these characters live now. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, Will Hastings in the war was the most real person I have ever read in my life.
Yes.
And his girlfriend, whose name I'm not going to say yet,
mm-hmm.
grew up there. And I went to the clerk's office to find out where they were married and where they lived and where they were buried, and I couldn't find them. And I wanted you to tell me where they've moved to.
Yes.
And I said, they've moved to my head. They're characters that I created so that you would feel them from their hearts out to their skin and from their
right.
heads to their toes, and you would live as if you were living and walking in their shoes. And what makes this wellness concept real in the books that I try to write is something that I learned in school in creative writing classes, that a novel is 1,000 lies assembled to tell a single truth.
Absolutely. Well, Jack, But your story, it just takes you on such a journey. I think with that man's experience, I almost could feel the sense that I might have done that too. Do you know what I mean?
It's I hope
sort
so.
Of like we want to go and say, ooh, you know, I'm in my 60s and I speak to elders at end of life all the time. We want to say, you know, let's tell me your stories. And then it kind of connects generations in a way, because sometimes we listen to people's stories and they say, oh, same old thing over and over again. When really, are you listening for the golden threads in their stories of the elders and being able to say, well, tell me about this. How about that? What were you feeling? Can you tell me what the day was like? In other words, it's almost, can you do a script writing of the book? Because when you do the script writing of the book, you're really enmeshed in the full experience. Your books, all of them, are script writing books because you feel as if you are eating, breathing, sensing every emotion. And that's what I got from your work.
Well, I'm flattered, and that's very kind of you to say. I hoped that someone like you reading the books would encounter a chapter in which Will, for example, is involved in the war, and you would feel as if you were walking in Will's shoes. You saw
right.
what he saw. You worried about what he worried about. And then a little later, one of his fellow soldiers, Private Curtis, goes on a trial. And you feel that you know what Curtis did and you know why he did it, and you don't know whether he's going to get away with it or not.
Right.
Every character I drew, I wanted someone to believe they were that person, or they knew that person, or at least they lived in that person's skin for a little while. That is listening.
Absolutely. And you know what I think the important part is, too? At now in this time of life, I find that the internet is spinning so fast. We're moving so fast. People are living much longer. So there are so many more elders, as I call elders anyone over 50. But anyway, there's so many more elders that are able to share their life stories. And I think sometimes these are getting lost. And what you did with your books was really created such a moment in time that if anyone's over the age 50, they would thoroughly enjoy these books because they would feel as if they were there re-experiencing and maybe connecting with something they may have lost in their own experience. Or they will maybe say, I can now connect with my father or my brother in a deeper sense. Or also, too, well, I really didn't know this stuff was going on the earth at the same time my elders were having these other experiences. Don't you think all of those are playing out in time right now?
Let me set the books up just as a series for you. All three books are called French Letters. That term is a term that has at least two meanings. One meaning is letters that are written back and forth from America to France.
Mm-hmm.
And another meaning is a slang term from that period, from the 1940s, in which a French letter was a latex contraceptive.
Mm-hmm.
It was to prevent things from happening.
Right.
The play on words is designed to make you wonder about the first book, Virginia's War,
right.
And it's about a woman named Virginia, not a war that took place in Virginia, but Virginia's personal battle to become a person.
Mm-hmm.
And she does this by trying to act out against her family and her hometown in one of the very few ways that women had available to them back in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
The second book is a parallel book written covering exactly the same time frame with her boyfriend, Will, who's in France in combat as an army doctor. The third book is their children, written 40 years later in the 1980s.
Right.
Now, why did I do this? At our age, you and I have heard people say that our parents got a lot smarter the older you and I got.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I know that as I grew up, my parents weren't nearly as dumb as they used to be. Until finally, by the time I was had children of my own, my parents were quite smart.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to create some perception in the third book of two boys who were brothers who just detested each other and really didn't give much thought to their own parents until they began to slip away. At the same time, when we realize that our parents were smart, we only think of them as things they used to do with us, things they used to tell us, and we rarely think of our parents when they were in their teens and in their 20s before they had us.
As people.
They were humans. They were people mm-hmm. before they were parents.
Right.
Now, all of them, our parents, their parents, our friends' parents, had experiences. They had secrets. They had things they should never have done. They made bad choices, and they lived through it. And so I wanted these two warring and feuding brothers to have to go back in time and investigate their parents' lives that even took place before they were born. And in this case, those lives took place during the 1940s, during the most world-changing war that the world has ever known. And so that's what the three books are. A book about mom, a book about dad, and a book about their two children who are having this Jacob and Esau life and death struggle because they hate each other without knowing any of the history or the family secrets that brought about who their parents were and who these two boys are today.
What I find so interesting about it, too, is that, you know, on the Internet now, we think we know everything about everyone when we really truly know nothing because we're only just putting up an illusion so that it could be liked or passed on or shared. And I think your books are really about the deep, intimate source of each person. In other words, you know, as you said, you know, you've done things maybe that you shouldn't have done or gone here and said something you shouldn't have said. I think sometimes we go, you know, as I work with end-of-life clients, is my gosh, their satchel of, you know, regrets and shames and guilt is so much bigger than the heavens that they're carrying along with them. I think they never release it. And I think the idea is that as your characters have gone through the chain of finding out about their parents, isn't that really learning about forgiveness, understanding, and unconditional love that we should have in the first place?
One of the boys has a belief that his father had gone through World War II and had been a war hero, while this boy himself went through the Vietnam War and knew that he was a war coward. And he was confronted with the idea that he knew what he had done in Vietnam. He had been part of a group that absolutely hated his superior officer and wished they had killed him. They didn't, but they wanted to.
Right.
He had gone off and slept with Vietnamese girls. He had been ashamed of it, but he had done it. He had done all sorts of things, mostly to just try to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, he realizes that not only did his father go through war in France, but his father must have experienced exactly the same things.
Right.
Terrifying fear in combat, a hatred of a superior officer who really is just one of the villains of history, dealing with local girls, and caring about where you were as much as caring about what you were fighting for, and taking it all home and keeping it a secret.
Don't you think, Jack, that sometimes in war, when a lot of these, your characters have played out their stories, it truly was a sense that you see people getting killed, you're engaging in that process, and you're almost believing that if I only have till tomorrow, well, I'm going to live my moment today. I think, in other words, they didn't believe in a future. They didn't believe they were ever going to make it till they were 100. They had no concept of what that might be You know, I think it was really truly living for the moment, because this might be their only moments, yes?
I think that objectively, all of us would look at other people in war who engage in conduct that they would never engage in at home and believe that what they're doing is expressing the desire to live in the moment because tomorrow we're going to die.
Right.
A perfect example of that is American soldiers in England during World War II. British women took to American soldiers like flies to candy, and American soldiers took to them. Suddenly, we had something on the order, and my number may be off, 440 or 460 thousand war brides or war marriages, not only in England but in other parts of the world during World War II. And they married these people not only because they hoped that they would live with them the rest of their lives, but that they could be with them before they died.
Right.
We had people who in Vietnam were shooting their superior officers in hopes that they could survive another day. So they were doing things that they should never have done at home, in a situation in which they should never have been placed, which was out of their control, and taking their destiny into their own hands.
Do you think that now in 2019 we look back at these stories and we want to base our thoughts about it with our 2019 judgment finger?
Yes.
In other words, you know, we would never do things like this today. However, we want to judge all of those who have done those things then. You know, and even if you look at wartime, they reflect it back on the cowboys and Indians' time, or, you know, overtaking areas of the U.S. or whatever, you know, the gold rush and all this other stuff. In other words, for each kind of great leap that humanity takes out of one section, do we kind of look back at it and always want to wag our finger at it? But now that people are living so much longer, are we having a little bit of overlap?
Well, that was a lot of questions. First, I do think that we're trapped by our current experiences into judging the past on our terms rather than on its terms.
Right.
And as fewer of us go into public service, I think more of us have a gap in our understanding of the demands and sacrifices that are called upon.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up during the draft. I became an Army officer in the war. And so what my colleagues and I did was normal. We entered the Army. We did as we were ordered to do.
Right.
The draft ended in the mid-70s. Now we have an all-volunteer Army. And it's much, much, much smaller than our Army.
Right.
And we have this sincere belief that what we went through was thrust on us and that we would do it exactly the same way if we did it again, only we would never want it done again because Kennedy, Nixon, Johnson surely wouldn't make that same mistake twice.
Right.
But when you hover over it from 30,000 feet and look down, it seems that we are making the same mistakes again, even though the Army is smaller. We're mm-hmm. still involving ourselves in other people's wars with an outcome of allegedly fighting them to bring our way of life to them and win their hearts and minds. And in the meantime, we're killing them locally, as we did in Afghanistan and in Iraq.
Right.
And then judging them for what they're doing in the situation into which we've put them.
Yeah. I think the idea that if we look at it, are we truly expanding or evolving as human beings from all of those decades ago? Sometimes we say we are. Sometimes we feel like we're doing the same kind of dance in a circle. And sometimes we say, I just want to put up my wall of denial and, like, walk on.
I think we're being bombarded by inputs. So much comes into each of our heads every day through things that didn't even exist 20 years ago, particularly the internet, email, social media, and then the entire change that we're currently experiencing in entertainment that is such certainly more violence-based entertainment. So as young adults or middle-aged adults now, we will have seen 30 or 40 or 50,000 killings on television or in the movies by the time we're 20 years old. And we will have a false belief that those are easy and that the guy will eventually get up after the movie's over and go live again. And we don't have much appreciation for the finality and the lack of need to go around killing other people, whether in war or individually, because it's become such a casual part of our daily experience, watching someone die in a video game, in a movie, in a television show.
Right.
So is that progress? I would argue it is not progress, that it is going back to the pre-Middle Ages when the savage battles took place for territory between Attila the Hun, the Visigoths, the Vikings, whomever.
Right.
That we are not learning from that experience, we're simply multiplying it. At the same time, we are living longer, again, because of World War II. All it took in World War II to change the world was clean water and penicillin.
Mm-hmm. Right.
People who died in childbirth stopped dying in childbirth. People who died at age 40 now live to age 80. The population of Northern Africa and the Middle East has gone up 9 times since 1944. The population is 9 times larger. The life expectancy is more than double what it was. People have vastly more education then. Almost all of them are guaranteed the equivalent of a high school education. And because of oil money or other resources, they can be educated. They can have health care. They just can't create jobs other than a few limited industries, there's no work there to be had. So the opportunities for conflict increase. The opportunities for self-preservation are more threatening. We haven't learned a thing from resolution of conflict. And so, yes, we're dancing that same circle again.
I'm going to say this to Jack for a second because I'm going to cut this piece out. Do you know I live in the city of New Orleans, and since Katrina, as we would say, there's a certain population, they're young black men, and we've watched them, they're ages 15 to 25. What they're doing now is they're destroying everything. They're destroying all the cars, the buildings, the people. They're shooting each other. They're killing off their girlfriends with babies. They're shooting their parents. They're randomly going out around and killing people. And what it is that sense of connection that, you know, when what the Katrina did, you know, it took away families. It screwed everything up. It was almost like an innate kind of war within a community that just threw it to the hell, you know what I mean? Just like a bomb landed and everybody had to fight for themselves, self-preservation. And it was something because, you know, it's getting to be, there have been several of these where someone ended up being on the interstate and the interstate, you know, people just going, you know, 100 miles an hour, they just ran over them like dogs and you'd see pieces of them all over the highway. And they would have it on the news, well, it's shut down because we have to clean up the highway. And you look back in the story, and it was because the body was just dismembered all over the highway. So what you're saying is like, I mean, I see it play out all the time, and it's just, I just don't know where we're going as humans anymore. And it just, you know, your books kind of drew me into another story. But when I thought of it, I just said, man, look at this story that we're creating now and how awful, right?
One of the great stories of New Orleans is that circular dance that we were talking about. The young people who do not have jobs, do not have strong family histories, mm-hmm. who lost, I suppose, on the order of several hundred thousand
mm-hmm.
relatives, friends, and nears,
right.
who were part of the Louisiana diaspora after Katrina,
okay.
now are searching for roots, searching for work, searching for something permanent. It's not there, and they're raging. Or just,
it's the sense of self is gone because, you know, I mean, I've lived here for since 1974, and I stayed for Katrina. You know, we stayed and we got flooded in and everything. So we went through the same experience. It's just how they reflect on the experience, but they totally lost their sense of self.
Well, you know? One of the great stories of this circular dance is that probably from 1820 to at least 1875, what you're describing would not have happened mm-hmm. in the black population of New Orleans and its suburban parishes, because black lives were too valuable mm-hmm. to allow to disintegrate like that.
Right.
So when it was time to build the levees from Canal Street out mm-hmm. to Uptown, the work was not done by black people because the yellow fever and malaria were such high dangers of destruction that the people who were financing those projects said, let's use Irish labor instead.
Right.
There are so many Irish and nobody cares if they die.
Yep.
And so the value of life in New Orleans continues to be iffy. It's just that the people at risk continue to do this slow circle around the wheel, and you're never quite clear who's going to be the risk group from one century to the next.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yes, and I'm Irish, and I'm back here. So something brought me back because I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I was brought back. I literally feel like I was brought back. My one suitcase was packed, and I was brought back here. So it's, in some essence, I guess I'm playing out some sort of wheel also. Anyway,
well, you're a part in it. You may take charge of it. It's hard to know, but certainly, the Louisiana experience is mm-hmm. unique to the United States. One of the great stories of Louisiana was that there were black slaveholders, mm-hmm. and these black slaveholders formed a company of black militia to defend the Confederacy in 1862. When the Federal Army took over New Orleans, they simply burned their uniforms and formed a new company of blacks who were in charge of a company for fighting for the North.
Right.
It was expedient. You have to survive.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we are surviving as a... Are we looking for the survival, as within your books and what I had shared is about, are we looking for the survival, excuse me, of the human body,
no.
or the human existence,
yes.
or are we taking it at the expenditure of our soul and our knowing?
What I think I wanted you to learn is in reading these three novels, everyone you thought you were is not necessarily who you are.
Right.
And you have to find out for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The story is told from Mom's point of view for an entire book in which she is trying to tell the world who she is. The story is told from Dad's point of view saying, I've lost everything.
Right.
And I'm going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's told from the points of view of their two children who really did not know them. One of them saying, you, sir, don't belong to us at all. You are a bastard. You are not
right.
of this family. And that second boy, being persuaded that he was an illegitimate child brought back from the war, goes out to find out who he really is by searching for his real parents. And when it comes down to the essence of my message, it is that we are almost never who other people think we are. We hide that from them.
Yeah.
But we almost always have to also find out for ourselves who we really are. And we may be the biological children of our natural parents, and they certainly will influence the kind of people we become. But we have to make the choice of who we are and then how we're going to live that out.
Because I think we have to, we can go through the story and find out where we came from. However, we can also remember that we don't have to carry those imprints with us. Do you know what I'm saying?
No, but I love that expression.
Yeah. Well, because we sometimes, you know, people will say, well, my father fought in the war, I have to fight in the war, and then you find them fighting their own mind with their own mental health condition. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, Lieutenant Dan Forrest Gump's erstwhile
right.
leader, who not only had to go to Vietnam, but he had to be killed because all of his ancestors for hundreds of years had joined
right.
the army and been killed. And
right.
he lost his mind when he could not live up to his ancestral expectations.
Right. And I think also, too, the idea of starvation, of not having enough, of having to climb that proverbial ladder. I mean, we see it now playing out in social media. You know, well, I never went to college. My kids have to. And by gosh, I'm going to do everything so they can. You know, that idea of, do we carry those old wounds and take those old wounds and almost wear them like a Boy Scout badge? Do you know what I mean? Every single day. Are we carrying those old wounds and saying, I come from this, so I rise up like this? Do you know what I'm saying?
In
other
I do.
Words, did our parents, in essence, or have we as humans over decades, dug a hole in the ground, put a stake here and says, this is where you're going to land next, you know? And each time, it's almost like we're following someone or some things or history's other path versus having this exponential wealth to create our own life.
I encourage you to share with your readers, your listeners, and your patients the experience they had when their parents passed away
mm-hmm.
and they cleaned out their parents' home.
Yes.
Almost always,
yep.
they break that into three groups. They go up in the attic or go into the closets or go into the rooms,
yep.
the cupboards, the pantries, and they find something and they say, I remember this.
Yes, absolutely.
Number two, I never knew this was here. Mom
mm-hmm.
must have kept this since the Depression. Dad must have had this since 1962. And then number three, there's almost always more stuff than you could possibly imagine, but they could not turn loose of it. And when you go through it, you see a bit of your parents' lives
mm-hmm.
at stages in which they lived them. They might be magazines from the 50s. They might be ration books from the 40s.
Right.
They might be playbills from the 1930s. It could be anything. My mother, I'm going to age myself. My mother, I was the youngest, by the way,
mm-hmm.
was born in 1910. She always loved saying that she grew up on a farm, which she did do, and the farm had a party line telephone, and that she was the only one not out in the fields working when the phone rang, and she picked up the phone and had the party line message that she passed all over her little county up in the panhandle of Texas. World War I is over.
Uh-huh.
The operator called out on a party line. Someone picked it up and passed it on down the line. And she ran out to tell everyone Kaiser Bill is dead, which frankly wasn't quite true, but
mm-hmm.
they did win the war, and she was the one who passed it on. Well, I froze that image of my mother, a little girl in, you know, some cotton sack dress running out into the fields to say the war was over.
Right.
My image changed completely of my mother when we went through her effects after she passed away. I discovered her high school scrapbook, which
mm-hmm.
was the equivalent of a high school yearbook.
Right.
There were photographs of her and her classmates. They wrote little letters to each other and put them in their scrapbook. They had one or two little clippings from things that they had done. And it told me a lot more about my mother as a young woman than the vignette of her answering the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Then, about 6 or 7 years later, she married my father. I know nothing of their wedding. I know nothing of their early married life. But I know that my mother was a college student in the 1930s. When women could not go to school and women couldn't get a job because of the Depression.
Mm.
And somewhere I stumbled along a sheaf of papers from her college days. It was something simple, like one or two reports that she had written, mm-hmm. grades that she had gotten, a list of her classes, that sort of thing. And I learned more about my mother from that than I had ever known before. And when we clean our parents' attics, some of it we put in our attics, and some of it we just put away.
Right. You know, what I have found is that that is such a lost art. And I think with your books, it's about how do we create or hold on to memories or stories so that maybe those lovely gems will be found eons and decades later. Because I think we aren't talking about our stories, we aren't sharing about them, or we're just giving bits and pieces. And people are saying, I don't really even know anymore. But yet I'm even still finding, I know with myself, I said to the kids, you know, I'm cleaning out this stuff. What did y'all want? And they're like, throw it all away. I don't want any of your stuff. And I went, oh, okay. And I think we're sometimes people are struggling with the sense of family members or friends or acquaintances. We say or we're using the words, they really don't even know the me that I am. They just know of the actions that they'd like to reference. And I think what your book is about is they knew parts and bits and pieces of all the characters of each other and the family members. And then as they went on this exploration, it was almost like it filled in all of the pieces. The letters were like puzzle pieces, and each moment and location and each time and frame really filled in a picture that you could really see someone as a real human being in all of their struggles and all of their glory times of their life. Don't you think that that's so vitally important to keep?
That's what I set out to do.
Yeah.
The books begin with the idea that there is this horrific conflict between the two brothers, which does become the core of the story. But it immediately goes into Mom and her friends. And we learn who Mom was, and we learn who her friends were, and then we learn who her enemies were.
Right.
Some were
right.
true friends, some were shallow, backstabbing people who wanted you to believe they were friends, but they were not. And some were out-and-out crooks, and some were really nice people.
Mm-hmm.
Then we learn the same thing about Dad. We see him tunked into the Army. We find out that he was much closer to the men that he worked with than the people under whom he was ordered to serve. We learned that he cared much more about what happened to them on the battlefield than what happened to them back in a safe place at base or at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Slowly but surely, these two boys, 40 years later, have to go back and find out who Mom's and Dad's friends were, who their enemies were, what their secrets were, and why they kept them, before they could ever find out who they were themselves.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, these friends come calling as funerals happen and as family events take place. People they've known all their lives show up, and their true colors show up.
Yeah. You know, Jack, I think as we've now in 2019, I even look at it as, I can't tell you, I haven't been to a funeral in like maybe once or twice in my whole life, and I'm in my 60s. And I think sometimes when we look back on it, the ways that we are as humans and evolving, we say, are these old things going by the wayside? Are letters that we wrote to our loved ones, are the moments that we felt are really our human existence was really hanging on the edge, are we losing these moments? Or are we saying, they don't matter anyway. You know, I'm off in the universe. Hey, I'm going to be signing up to go in the spaceship next year, you know, kind of idea. And we say, is this part of the human, really core of their heart? I think you captured a human heart in every single page of all of your books. And that really is what we were talking about is, can we get into that space and see the real value of each soul? Because, I mean, if we keep continuing along the path we're going on, that it's all this external minutia, and nothing else really is important, how can we really even find any value in existing?
The very first thing you said when we began the conversation was that we don't listen to each other anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And what Will and Virginia did in Book 1 and Book 2, Virginia's War, Engaged in War, was they observed the other people around them, whether it was Virginia in her small town and the families who were cheating on ration books, or whether it was Will and his army unit arguing with his supervisor over whether he could or could not do surgery on a wounded local person.
Right.
And they listened to these people. And then they acted as they believed that they should act. Their children were caught up in a much, much faster world in which suddenly there are personal computers, there are CD players, there is airplane travel, that everything has happened at a much, much faster pace. And there's less time to listen to people and less time to observe what they're doing. Dr. Jeanette, you and I are caught up in an even much faster time.
Yeah.
In which your email inbox has 30 to 60 letters a day.
Yeah.
And almost none of them are as important as a single handwritten letter from 20 years, 40 years, or 60 years ago in which you sat down and composed a sincere message to another person on paper,
yeah,
told them what you thought, told them what experiences you had had, carried it to the post office and mailed it, or opened one and read it, because we have cheapened all of our daily contact by flipping it into an email or posting it on social media and sharing it with hundreds of others.
Mm.
And part of that is or should be scaling back what's in our heart of hearts,
right,
unless you want hundreds of others to grade your paper.
You know, I don't think that we can put together what a human is and what is in their heart until we start to listen and reflect, listen and hear stories of others. And I think your books are great about being able to show how others have engaged in life, because sometimes you can reflect upon your life today and say, well, I don't think about that. That's not important. But if you can read it in a book like yours, Jack, is really about saying, well, maybe it is important in reflection. In other words, what we think is important today may or may not be, but 20 years from now, we may look back on it and say, wow, look at that moment, that gem. And isn't that the real gift of life? I think that, in other words, walk through life with eyes wide open, ears open, and engage in it, and then reflect on it. That's what we're talking about. Because sometimes when you're in a war, or you're in a hardship, or you're having something going on, or, you know, as your characters, when they're just flipping out when something's going on, the children, it's sort of like you really don't even see anything. But then when you reflect on it, you go back and you say, I remember something. I sense something. I feel something. Where is it coming from? That'll take you on your own other journey, yes?
Yes. One of my favorite experiences in writing the books was when an editor on, I don't know, page 100, scratched through three or four lines in which I had set out what the dog was doing and that the dog was barking, and said, don't need to know what the dog was doing and that the dog was barking.
Oh, wow.
And then 5 pages later, she wrote back in, oops, I was wrong, that the dog was seen to bark really did make a difference.
Yeah.
And then she went back and deleted her deletes.
Right. As
and
it is,
the
only
little,
in reflection.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The little things that we don't pay any attention to do have meaning.
Right.
We can cheapen them by sending them out in 100 emails or posting them on social media or by disregarding those that others have sent to us. But the little things do have meaning.
And to know that someone else actually felt maybe just as heartbroken as you did, or just felt lost all the way to their core, or maybe was having some trials within, they just felt they couldn't think straight, or their thoughts were just jumbled and everything was coming up for them when they found out information or history or something or where they were in that moment. I think to just know that someone or something else has experienced that same threshold of emotion and I call it almost soul diversion, you know what I mean? In other words, you're just so exposed, it's just laying it all on the line. I think once you can sense that and feel that, it really shifts your energy to be able to stand up the next day and keep going. And that's what really we're talking about, because if we think about it, in the war, they didn't have that. They just knew they just had to get their butt up the next day or else they were done. And they had that inner core sense, but now we're like, we just need to keep going because we can keep going forward, yes?
You've described a dividing line. When you're in the war, there's a great deal of personal comfort in knowing that you don't have to make any decisions at all, just get up the next day and go forward
right.
and do what you're told.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the course of that, you have to keep an eye out on what you're doing or you'll get killed a lot more quickly than you otherwise might do.
Right.
But, you know, you're under someone's orders somewhere, and everything is regimented, waking up, getting dressed, eating, packing, loading up your gear, marching out, crawling under a tree, looking
mm-hmm.
for the enemy, whatever you're doing. And those experiences give us a great deal of comfort in the regimentation of it. Then
right.
the other side of that is when we're not under regimentation, sometimes we do feel wildly adrift. We don't know what's coming. We don't know who to tell us how to behave. And our thoughts do become jumbled. We do become lost. We do reach for lifelines. And we have to find out for ourselves how to make decisions and how to go forward.
I think in the beginning with the regimented war is that really it was all about we were humans and we were living from an outside existence. Now we're truly learning about what is the inside human existence in a spiritual context. And I think that that is really so vitally important as we move forward and be able to say in reflection, I would like to see the whole circle. And I think we are now seeing, as you shared within your books, you're seeing the whole circle of life, how it plays out, the good, the bad, the ugly, the ups, the downs, you know, that stuff that hit the wall when you threw it at it, and that stuff that really, you know, you fell into a hole. And I think to understand that all of that is acceptable as a human existence, we don't have to just share the highlights as they're just like, you know, the little gold, you know, emblems on your shirt, and forget about the rest of it. So I think really what you're sharing is your book is all the characters, their whole entire existence, and it just is a wonderful, glorious, almost like garden, you know, almost to speak, because you're seeing everything of everyone on every page, yes?
I hope that you found that the books were like being on a river and floating downstream, and that sometimes you were in flat water and sometimes rocky water and
right.
sometimes in a waterfall.
Right.
And that life is not a postcard. It is a flowing, continuous, glorious experience. And it does have its deaths, but it also has its births. It has its mistakes, but it also has its successes. It has its heartbreak, but it also has its pride. But
yeah,
we have to listen to others and observe them and have a strong sense of how not to go through life hurting other people, but to live with some degree of dignity.
Yeah, I think the respect for the human moment is really, truly something that seems to waver these days. You know, Jack, in closing, I think that what we can listen and learn, what we can learn from your books is about listening, about reflection, about understanding, really unwavering forgiveness, definitely unconditional love. And I think not only for ourselves and those around us right now, 2019, but also for all of our ancestors, for the walks that they have had in their own lives and how they've created this, as you said, you know, this river going forward. Because, you know, hey, we just didn't get dropped from a stork, right? People had to go through ups and downs in their lives. I know myself, you know, my ancestors came over here in the early 1900s from Lithuania and from Ireland. And, you know, I don't know any of the stories. They don't share them. And they were lost now for the decades. And I think to be able to, if you're able to dance with that, to dance with that, yes?
I think your story is out there. That in Lithuania and in Ireland and in all of those places in between, there were experiences that helped shape who you have become and that you would love to learn if you ever had the opportunity to sit down and go find them. And if not, you can do what I did. You can make them up.
Yeah. You can dance with the energies of their spirit, I think, sometimes, yes?
I agree.
Absolutely. Well, Jackie, it was such a pleasure to have you with us here to talk about your works. I love these books. This should be a movie. Did you ever think of that?
Well, I did think of that. And if someone wants to put together a screenplay and propose one, I'll be more than willing to help.
Absolutely.
But I loved writing them, and I very much enjoyed sharing this hour talking with you about them. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. Can you share with the listeners how to find out more information about your works? That would be great.
I have a website, jwlbooks.com. My email address, and I do answer my email, is jack@jackwlondon.com. And I probably will direct you to my newsletter, First Draft. The books are available at bookstores. I write under the name Jack Woodville London. The three books all are called French Letters, but they're individually called Virginia's War, Engaged in War, and Children of a Good War. And I also teach, and I have a book that is a nonfiction book on the craft of writing called A Novel Approach. And I'd be glad to hear from you and share with you, and I visit with nearly anyone about anything literary.
Jackie, it was such a pleasure. I really think that if we ever feel we're lost, just do a little bit reflection or be a little bit searching, yes? And I hope everybody reads these books. They're fabulous for elders, but it's also for others to learn how people have engaged in their life stories. So it's really a great collection.
Well, I hope so, too, and thank you for the kind words.
Oh, you're so welcome. If you'd like to find out more information about Jack Woodville London, please check on the link on the bottom of today's show page for all of his work. His books are great for any age. They're definitely wonderful for elders to sit down and read and engage in the times in which they have passed through, but also for others to understand how others have experienced life along the journey, what they've touched, what they're able to feel, what they're sensing with their heart, thinking with their minds, and seeing on a day-to-day basis. Please do check out Jack's books. They are absolutely wonderful. Wonderful package of three books. Please do check them out. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. Till tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.